Welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. My name is Alan Wilson, and I'm the host of the podcast. Each week, I'll be talking to various Christian leaders, discussing some of the things that have contributed to the story of their leadership, and at the same time, encouraging you to reflect on your own leadership journey. You can subscribe to the podcast via iTunes. Just look for the Leadership Journey Podcast, and while you're there, you can leave us a review. Meantime, enjoy the podcast. Well, this week is the first episode of Season 2 of the Leadership Journey Podcast. We've been having a break over the summer. And my guest today, and over the next three episodes, in fact, is Phil Emerson. Phil is the founding pastor of Emmanuel Church in Lurgan. Phil, welcome to the Leadership Journey Podcast. It's good to have you on. Appreciate you taking the time.
It's good to be here.
To talk. You're actually the first episode of Season 2. Of this, I don't know whether that puts any extra burden on your shoulders.
No pressure.
as episode one goes, so the rest of the season goes. But it's good to have the opportunity to chat with you, Phil. Tell us a little bit in a nutshell what you do, what your role is.
Okay, I am one of the lead pastors in Emmanuel Church, which is based in Lurgan. It's now Lurgan and Portadown.
In Northern Ireland, just in case anybody's listening.
Northern Ireland,
outside, yeah.
Yes, County Armagh.
Yeah.
So, in the Emerald Isle. So, yes, I am there, have been there for, in that location from 2003. Pioneered the church back in 1996. Mm-hmm. So, I've been the pastor ever since.
So. Okay, so that's about 22 years.
22 years.
Did you recently celebrate 22?
Yes.
Yeah, you did.
Yes.
Yeah.
The 8th of September.
At our age, Phil, we can't really remember what date was last week.
You have to count back to the start date, haven't you?
Yeah, and I can't say at our age because I think there's about 2 months between us.
That's right.
We will let the audience guess what that might be.
I was going to say that. Who's the eldest?
Yeah, that's right. Both of us looking forward to free train travel, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay, Phil, let's go back to the beginning, because you're basically a Lurgan man, more or less.
Yes.
Growing up just outside. Tell us a little bit about growing up, where you grew up, and what family was like, and so on.
Okay, yeah, I was born on the south shores of Loch Ney, a place called Ardmore, which had a Lurgan address. It was about 5 miles, out in the country, but it had a Lurgan address, and I was the youngest of 7 kids. Mm-hmm. And I grew up a Brethren boy. My great grandfather actually pioneered the Brethren Assembly
in Ardmore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in the house I was born in, the house I was born into was the home of the Brethren Assembly in Ardmore. That's where it started
in your great grandfather's home.
Yeah.
Interesting then that, I mean, I'm jumping wildly forward here, but interesting that Emmanuel then would be born in your home.
Absolutely, I didn't know my great grandfather obviously, but his name was George, and the stories I remember growing up as a boy, I was intrigued with the stories of this man of God, mm-hmm. you know, who seemed to be revered in the country.
Was he a preacher or was he
not? Didn't seem to be. No, just seemed to carry clout, influence, I suppose, uh-huh. we would say, in the community. And I was quite intrigued by him. My grandfather was a good man too, again, not a preacher, nor was my dad, all believers. Mm-hmm. But my dad was a very quiet, unassuming man, again, with a great godly character. And very well revered and well thought of in the community. Everybody loved my dad. He was a businessman.
But folks would still see the lorries around the country, wouldn't they? The Emerson lorries.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. Grew up in the sort of building industry.
Yeah.
So we were part of that little Brethren Assembly in Ardmore.
Tell us some of the stories about your great-grandfather, some of the things that impressed you. As a boy, you know, what stands out from your impressions that were given to you of this man?
He lived up a long lane, and my mum and dad used to tell me stories of people who would just who would come up the lane to hear his wisdom, to talk to him, to come for advice, to come for prayer. You know, just he seemed to carry that. He seemed to be a bit of a magnet in the community that attracted people. And in the little house that I was born into, there was an end room. And I was always quite intrigued. It's actually still standing till today. And one of my brothers has turned it into like a machine shop. It's an old tin-roofed little hut. And he has a big industrial lathe in the room. But I still go into the room and stand in it. And it carries a bit of awe and a bit of... it's hard to put into words, but... I think you know why some things are caught, some things are taught, and I felt when I listened to the stories of him and stood in the room that he pioneered the Little Brethren Assembly in, that I caught something, you know, that couldn't be taught. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It does. So that was the room that he actually began.
That's where it started. That's where.
Now, what are you talking about? 80, 90 years ago?
I'm sure it is. I don't know the date.
Trying to work out mathematically what's the age difference between a great-grandfather and a great-grandson.
Because it's kind of funny. My grandfather lived till his 100th year. Uh-huh. He lived till, you know, late into his 99. And he used to talk about almost reached the ton. And that was his way of putting it. And then my dad, you know, my dad was almost, he was the second oldest in the family of 13. So it was a big connection of Emerson's down around Ardmore. You didn't want to say anything about an Emerson down around there. So it was a big, big family connection.
So your family then were very much involved with this Brethren Assembly in Ardmore.
Totally.
And that would have been a big part of your life as a child then?
Absolutely. It was sort of expected nearly, you know. It was a bit of a no-brainer, you know. And it was kind of funny because I was a... I got saved when I was six. I was just a boy, and I had an unusual zest. Like when I thinking back, I would probably call myself a weirdo. You know, it was just I had a weird obsession, almost to the point of with God. I just loved God with all my heart.
Even as a six-year-old,
as a boy, And it was like, my mum said this to me not long before she died. She said one of the things that she regretted was how she tried to dumb me down a bit, was her word.
Oh, right.
You know, she felt, you know. So I wanted to preach when I was 10 years of age, you know, and wanted to give out, so I was giving out hymns and praying around the table, you know. And of course, you weren't allowed to do that till you were baptized in the Brethren.
How did you get away with it then?
I didn't. You got scolded plenty.
Oh, did you really?
Aye,
But you said you got scolded plenty, so you didn't stop then.
No, I kept doing it, and then I got baptized the day after I got baptized on the 9th of December 1970, which was the day after my 12th birthday, I think, if that would be right. And I was born in 1958, so that'd be right. And then it was no holding me back after that, you know.
They could have stopped you.
And after that, then I, believe it or not, they built a gospel hall, just literally about 100 yards from where I lived. And in my teens, then I became the key holder. So I went and put the heat on a Sunday morning early, you know, staying locked up after every service.
But none of your brothers want to do this?
No, that's the weird thing about it. Not really. It's kind of, I don't know why, but it is kind of strange. It was just something that I think Saturday afternoons, I used to go, because I held the keys, I used to go and sit in the, you know, the... Back then, they sat in a circle around the table in the middle, and I would go and set that up on a Saturday afternoon and set the table up and put the tablecloth on and set the cup out. Uh-huh. Obviously, it wouldn't be filled or anything. Set the cup out and set the plate out. And I would sit in that circle, you know, just that this was God in the midst of us. Uh-huh. That this, you know, we're going to sit around this table tomorrow and... Uh-huh. Break bread
nobody was telling you to do any of this.
No,
but you see, I'm going back to your expression that you used earlier on about some things that are caught rather than taught.
Yeah.
somehow there was something in your heart that just drew you to this.
Something, and then, you know, and I've always had a bit of an, I think I've always been a bit of an evangelist, so that back then, and some, my Sunday afternoon was after the what we called our morning meeting, you know, we would go and have lunch, and it was a typical brethren home. You weren't allowed to watch the TV, you weren't allowed to kick a ball. Or
did you have TVs when you were that?
I remember. I remember us getting our first one,
yeah.
A black and white one.
I can remember us getting ours too.
But you weren't allowed to watch it, you weren't allowed to kick a ball or ride your bike or anything like that. And so my Sunday afternoon was, I used to just walk about a mile and a half either way from my home, giving out tracts. Uh-huh. Putting them through letterboxes, knocking doors, telling people about Jesus. And one of the funny stories was one of the old brethren elders in the church, apparently the big joke for years following was that I'd put a tract through his door, are you sure of your salvation? So which seemed to be quite, I'm glad to see it as amusing, but that was my sort of journey early days.
Yeah. I wonder about school and so on then. Did you go to school in Lurgan? Yeah.
I went to a country school, and then at 11 we went to junior high, which intermediate or junior high school. Mm-hmm. Went there, and again, just always had a real passion for God, you know, getting involved in issues, stuff like that, you know. Or people talk about, you know, getting harassed for your faith. I was always right and sturdy and could fight my corner, so nobody ever seemed to give me any hassle, and so I never ever remember, like, I don't ever remember getting persecuted for it in any shape or form, you know. Just I stood my corner and I kept my faith, you know.
Yeah. Were there particular people who began to influence you then?
Oh, massively.
Right. Talk about some of those early influences, individuals who might have influenced you.
The biggest influence probably in my whole life was an elderly man called Stevie Livingston. And Stevie led me to the Lord as a boy of six. And Stevie took me on my preaching career when I was... He tried to stall me until I got baptised. And then we went... after I was 12, every Sunday, I went with him somewhere every Sunday night to preach somewhere. And we preached in all these little brethren assemblies up County Cavan. He had a Vauxhall Viva. Mm-hmm. And we used to, and back in the day, Stevie's health wasn't wonderful. And like when I was 15 probably, he used to let me drive his Vauxhall Viva all the time, which is highly illegal and I don't recommend. But back then it just didn't seem to be the same issue as it. So like late on a Sunday night, I would, like from County Cavan, I would drive him at 15 and 16 years of age. I didn't realise I was breaking the law back then, but there you go.
So he was a bit of a door opener for you in a way.
Oh, he was incredible.
But was there more? Was there stuff that he taught you, or did you just learn from him the kind of man that he was?
It was such a humility. He just carried an aura of God about him. Again, you just caught it. You didn't like he wasn't a learned man. Uh-huh. He had a Bible that was just totally. I remember holding his Bible and feeling like I was holding,
I don't know, like something that was holy.
No, the Bible's holy, but
yeah, sure.
It was like
the actual physical book was sacred or something.
Some of the pages were just, you knew that, you know, were brown with tears. He was just one of those men who, you know, wept over his Bible, and he used to say to me on the way home, he had this little way, you know, he had this little way. He would say, Phil, that was really good. That was really good today. But you kept using this little phrase over and over again, you know, and he just taught me, you know, and, you know, he used to say to me, don't be afraid of pausing. Don't be afraid of waiting on it to come. If something's not, you know, come into your mind, you know, wait on it, you know, allow the Holy Spirit to move. And he just taught me. He just taught me the principles of preaching, of life. He was my biggest. Him and my mum were my two biggest influencers in life.
How did your mum influence you?
I was her youngest, and if any of my brothers are listening to this, they'll be really cross. But I think there was
you were the favourite.
We did have a pretty unique relationship. There was no doubt about that. She used to say that every one of her kids she wanted to call Philip, and somebody talked her out of it every time. So she said when I came along, she was 38 years of age, and she knew there was probably going to be no more. So she'd set her mind that this was going to be her Philip, you know. So we, and maybe just being the youngest, I don't know, but we did, even to the day she died, you know, I was with her when she died at 87. She was one of the most godly. She was mom-like, you know. She licked her hanky and wiped my face, which I never forgive her for. And all of that, she was my mom, and she you know, she would give us the wooden spoon now and again. But there was something about her, especially the final years of her life, that she was just carried something that I caught again, that, you know, that. So I like that, you know, I like that whole analogy. So there were my two biggest heroes in my life, really.
Yeah. Were there any sort of early indications of leadership? You know, were you the guy who put his hand up and said, I'll take responsibility for this? I mean, obviously, you were doing a lot of things that your peers and even your older brothers weren't doing. But were you leading things, leading other groups of people? Were they following you?
I tend to think sometimes, funny you ask that, Alan, I do tend to think about that sometimes. You know, I think two things I would say. My dad owned his own business, and he wasn't the smartest businessman in the world. He was a hard worker back in the day. You know, he was a hard, hard grafter, and so much so he was probably a little bit of a distant father. I think that's why I was so close to my mum. You know, you knew that he loved you and he was a good provider, but I actually don't ever remember going anywhere with my dad in my life. You know, he was busy, and so don't ever remember him kicking a ball or going on a holiday or anything like that. Or, you know, and back in, you know, a lot of that was just with my mum, you know. So, but he was a good man. But I remember listening to him talking around the table. He was a risk taker, and I think that's where I got that. You know, I know I'm a risk taker. So much so, some people say, you know, it's been my greatest strength and my greatest weakness. I suppose that's right, the best way to put it.
I'd love to come back to that because I probably want to suggest that if you're going to be a pioneer as you have been, there's by definition there's a risk in that.
There's no doubt about that, and I think again I'm one of those people who jump out of the plane and wonder have a parachute on, you know, and I've done that a few times in my life to my cost, you know.
Not literally.
No, not literally, but in ministry and in business I've done some silly things, you know, in hindsight. But then hindsight's a wonderful thing too, isn't it?
Of course it is.
And so that I think listening to him, I remember one of the conversations around the table was that they just started to build the Channel Tunnel, and this is back. This must have been in the 70s. And the whole thing was some of these people were earning £100 a week. It was like, and I remember this. I remember, you know, eavesdropping on this conversation with some businessmen around the table. This was like, imagine earning £100 a week, you know, and so he was a bit of a risk taker. So I think I inherited some of that. The second thing I would say was that as a boy, I realized from the Romans 12 giftings that there's a gift of leadership. That I remember reading that as a boy, and I remember thinking, well, it does seem that when I went to secondary school, I was only there, you know, Phil, will you lead this? Will you lead the SU? Will you lead?
Well, that did happen.
All the time. It felt like you were always been pushed into places of, you know, you were the only place I didn't lead was playing football. I was the one, you know, do you want them? No, no, you
can't. They forget, yeah.
So,
it's like the labourers in the parable that Jesus tells about the vineyard labourers, and there's the boys who are still standing around, you know, you know, at the end of the afternoon, yeah. You know, and they're, well, you might as well come and work as well.
That's right. Well, I was that. Well, I never was much of a leader when it came to sport, but I did seem to acquire leadership when I didn't actually want it. I seemed to get pushed into leading things without asking.
Yeah.
A lot.
You pushed into it without looking for it. Were you a reluctant leader, or were you quite, when people asked you to do stuff, were you quite happy to do it then once you were asked?
I think knowing your personality is good too, you know, and the personality types. I think there is a wee little, as there is maybe with a lot of leaders, there's a little bit of a superhero in us as well, you know, that and most pastors are good pastors because they like to be liked, you know. And
ouch.
And that's what makes us relatively good at our job, but it's also a negative for us as well. And
well, that's going to be a real point of discussion there, I think, you know.
I think there's always been a little bit of a superhero mentality that, you know, there is a bit of us in us that like to be needed and like to be, and so. But I think the three things for me was the risk taken from my dad, the fact that there was a Romans 12 gift of leadership that I felt maybe God had landed some on me, which I wasn't dead sure what it was all about, but I was certain sure I was going to journey in and try and find out. And the third thing was I felt I wanted to learn. I felt that, you know, the big question for me was, could leadership be taught? Did you have to be born a leader, or could you actually learn to be a leader?
What did you conclude?
I definitely think leadership can be taught.
Yeah,
I definitely do. I think it has to be in you.
Yeah.
And I always say, when I do my leadership talks, I say that, you know, there was a little bit of risk-taking I inherited from my dad. There was a chunk of leadership that I think God gave me from a Romans 12 gifting. And the rest,
yeah, that's really good.
You have to want.
I like that. You know, they did research. People did research, and sometime a number of years ago, to try to find out, you know, was leadership something you were born with?
Yeah.
And they researched. They followed twins to see, you know, comparing them and so on. Yeah. And they came to the conclusion, believe it or not, that about a third of what makes a leader is inborn.
Yeah.
But the rest then comes from, you know, as you say, learning. And. And I think also being shaped by experiences that we have.
That's
you know,
right.
You learn through all that.
I think the big thing for me too was, especially now, jumping on, you know, not to jump past where we are, but I think,
sorry, I'll keep bringing you back.
I think, you know, if you go to all the years past now, you know, I think in the last 10, 15 years, I began to really think about leadership again, because you start to think, there's people come into your, or if we're leading a church and people come into our church who, if you wanted to rate leadership on a 0 to 10, and you rated yourself as a 6, a 5 or 6, which in Ireland we're good at playing the humble pie thing, and we always strike about the middle.
So yeah, if you rate yourself as a 5 or 6, somebody's still going to think you've been a bit arrogant.
Yeah, that's right. But my little thought is, what do you do with an 8 or 9?
If they come into your church and you feel that you're only a 5 or 6.
And you feel somebody
keep talking about that.
Somebody sitting in your congregation that you feel is a really strong leader. Mm-hmm. How do you lead? Because you find people that carry a strong leadership gift. I find this anyway. It's not that they're arrogant. I just think they can't be bothered with fluff.
Yeah.
You know, if they're part of something and they think that if they think you haven't a clue what you're doing, they're not going to hang around, because they can't be bothered with that, you know. So I've felt over the last, I suppose, 20 years. So if you're saying about a third of, that's probably a really good estimate. So if a third of my leadership gifting was inherited and a leadership gift had been given me from God, then that other two thirds for me, I wanted to, I said, God, I want this. I want this. Not that you rate yourself to be a number 10 leader, because that, you know, we're always in the learning process, But I knew that I wanted it. I wanted God to, and I wanted God to teach me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wanted God to teach me, and I wanted to put myself in a place where I could get around mm-hmm. smart leaders. And so I've done a little thing over the years. For the last, those 30 years, at least 3 or 4 times a year, I seek somebody out that I feel... And all these people haven't always been Christians, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
They're just who I've felt have been really, really good leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've rang them up. I've done a little thing where I've rang them up and I've said, would you give me 1 hour of your time? Would you allow me to buy you a coffee or a lunch? And could I ask you 3 questions? And I'm not asking you for anything else outside that.
Mm-hmm.
Please hear me, I'm not asking to be your pen pal, or I'm not going to be a Klingon out of Star Wars, but I'd love 1 hour.
Yeah.
And I've never had anybody refuse me
uh-huh.
yet.
Uh-huh. What are the 3 questions?
It all depends, very different, okay. You know, just probably...
It's not like a set.
No, just very seasonal where, mm-hmm. where I might be. So, you know, I remember whenever we began to be a church where we employed staff,
mm-hmm.
that was a biggie, you know, I remember ringing... I remember ringing, Tommy TBF Thompson and going through the loops to try and get talking and had a little bit of a thing there because Tommy Thompson was very friendly with my dad
right.
and he was such a godly man, as you will well know. And, you know, and asking him, I need to know, I have a couple of questions. I want to know, you know, how to manage staff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do we do to keep the structures right? You know, how do I keep ministry and the ministry mindset, you know, in a model that actually begins to employ people? So those were all big questions that I felt that I could learn from somebody who was a little bit further down the line and a little bit smarter than
it's me. It's a really great idea. I think it's a humility in that, you know, to say... For you to recognise that there's something that you don't know, but to recognise that other people have it. And I think even from a practical point of view, anyone listening to the podcast, especially younger leaders, but not exclusively, to have that, I guess, the humility to recognise their own limitations, but to go and do it. I mean, there are enough people around who are examples of good leadership. Can I ask you, though... One of the things I find intriguing is let's say a leader rates himself 5 or 6,
mm-hmm.
and there's an 8 or a 9 comes into the church. How do you make the most of that then, without either feeling intimidated or whatever, or without even maybe bending over, you know, doing everything you can just to please that person?
Yeah.
How do you relate to that person? So it's not just a person you're phoning up to have a lunch with. But it's someone who's there week by week. How do you relate to that?
I think one of the things that, you know, from a church perspective, what I've tried to work really hard at, you know, and our team is brilliant. And, we have a little saying down from the Loch Shores of Loch Ness that everybody thinks their own duck's a swan. And I do think our duck's a swan. I think that we've got the best leaders, the best team of people, and so one of the things that we've done in Emmanuel is I think we've worked hard to make sure our structures are way up there. Mm-hmm. So while personally you feel there's leaders who are far stronger than you,
mm-hmm.
I think one of the things we've been smart enough to do is to make sure we surround ourselves with strong leaders as well. You know, because I always say all of us are smarter than one of us,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so if we can grab a team that makes sure our structures and systems are really, really good. And the big thing as well in the day and age in which we live, if we're going to lead a church, right, that... Again, we've these little mantras that help us. So I always say to be soft at the door, we need to be strong at the core.
Uh-huh.
If we're going to be a church where anybody can come, we need to be really, really strong on what we believe and have systems really set in place. So I think our systems and structures are way up there, if that answers your question. You know, so I think the person in our church, while they mightn't see me as necessarily the strength of leader that they are, I think they can see that our structure, that we've built a group of people around that gives a very safe, strong structure that they can be part of. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. I think it's really helpful. There's a couple of very helpful things just around that whole issue of relating to leaders who've got maybe a greater capacity for leadership than we have. Because I think it is possible to be intimidated by them, isn't it?
Oh, there's no doubt. There's no doubt.
You can almost apologise for yourself or apologise for your own leadership because you're assuming this person's going to be better than you are.
I think asking for advice is great, you know, from people like that especially that you feel, you know, because you find people like that. As Bill Hybels used to talk about the power of the ask, you know, and you'll find that, you know, some of those people who carry very strong leadership giftings probably not the first people to tick a box in your volunteer sheet. But if you actually went and asked them, they almost need a strategic ask, you know, and you find that, you know, and we're all only human, aren't we?
We are. Well, listen, we're going to take a break here, Phil. I think we've covered, you know, some fascinating aspects of your childhood. We've touched on a couple of very interesting and very, very important leadership issues. So that'll give folk enough to think about. And we'll talk again next time.
Okay. Bless you.
Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Leadership Journey podcast. Phil will be back with us next week and we'll be exploring some more of his story, including how God gave him a heart for the people that he and Emmanuel Church are now reaching. Remember, you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and that will allow you to receive the podcast automatically. Or you can follow me on Twitter at JS Alan Wilson and you can watch for the link when the podcast goes live next week. In the meantime, have a good week and God bless you.